Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we are at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the show, Rob DeWalt will be with us speaking of the arts. Right now, I'd like to welcome Bruce McKenna. He is the creator, principal writer, researcher, and co-executive producer on the multi-Emmy Award-winning HBO miniseries, The Pacific. And he is giving a lecture on Tuesday, the 7th of December at the Armory for the Arts titled Hollywood Does History. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So you are, you started working with Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg in another series called Band of Brothers.
That's correct.
Which is how this Pacific, The Pacific came to be.
I wrote on four of the episodes of Band, which came out in 2001, 3 days before 9/11.
Oh, Lord.
and then 3 years later, 18 months later, they asked me to start working on The Pacific.
Now, this is a story that it's about American Marines fighting the Japanese in the Pacific in World War II, 1942. What is the drive to tell this story now?
It's a great question, and a few answers. Number one, because the American public has really no idea of what that war entailed in the Pacific. It was extraordinarily brutal. It was a violent affair that forever changed an entire generation of Americans in ways that really have never been examined, either in literature or in film. And secondly, we're at war now. We've been at war for longer than we were at war in World War II. And so, I felt it was important to show an audience, if you're going to go to war, this is what's going to happen to the young men and now young women who are fighting it. And the cost of war is, it's incalculable, morally, spiritually, economically, any way you want to look at it. And the Pacific really is an in-depth examination of the cost of war on the individual.
It's interesting to be watching. I watched four episodes of it last night, and it's interesting to be watching a war movie about a war that was really more or less universally considered to be a just war in a time where we are fighting wars based on, at best, dubious rationales and things like that, and where there's a lot of cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
The people who were in that war, they were just dying to go over there for moral reasons, as you depict in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it was very difficult to start writing this in 2003, 2004. Not a big fan of what we're doing in Iraq, and so how do I do this story? And I came to peace with the decision to do this because I realized that because it was a good war, it enabled us to go really deep and really dark without any politics. There's no polemicism in it. There's no politics. It's just, this is the face of war, and this is what war does to young men. And so you better think really hard as a society whether or not you want to go to war, because it's going to destroy everyone involved. And it does every generation. If you go to war, this is what's going to happen. And so the opportunity to do it without the, the red flags of politics and whatnot was a great, great opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, and when you are writing a drama, when you're writing a war drama, there's always this question of, you certainly depict the cruelty of war. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You also have to somehow make these characters appealing, which you also do. And then there's a question of heroes. Mm-hmm. What in this context, of brutality, does it mean to be a hero?
Heroes for a modern audience, and particularly in the Pacific, are those who can survive physically, morally, and spiritually. And you'll see that, in the Pacific, it really is a tale of survival. Can you keep your soul? Can you keep your moral compass? Can you regain your moral compass after you have killed? And those who can are heroes in the modern world. It's very different from Band of Brothers that we did in 2001, where it's more of a traditional notion of heroism, more of a classical definition of a hero. And the men themselves feel that way. When you interview the veterans, they're not interested in the hills they stormed. They're interested in, my God, we were able to get home, and And that was one of the things about the series that I'm really proud of, is to present real, real moral heroism in a 21st century sense.
The toll of war on men is huge. The toll of war on women is less talked about.
Yeah.
There are, and I haven't watched the whole thing yet. I've got 6 episodes to go, but I was thinking a lot about the character of a woman in Australia. It was shot in Australia, and part of it takes place there because there they are in the Pacific, and one of the soldiers meets this very appealing woman who then rejects him because she can't stand the idea that he might not ever come back.
Yeah. And that's episode 3, and it's really one of my favorite episodes because it shows something that most war movies don't show, and that is, number one, the crucial importance of women for warriors. To reestablish their humanity, to give them a moral grounding of what they're fighting for and what to return from, and the cost on the women themselves. You know, the fear and the this was a world war, and that doesn't just mean everywhere around the world. It means every level of society all over the world. And as you'll see later in the series, you know, it's incredibly tragic for mothers and wives and girlfriends and sisters. To lose their loved ones or to fear their loved ones. And the war, you know, it eroded everybody in that sense. One of my cherished memories of doing this series was being told by a woman whose brother went off to war. He's a character in the series. We showed her 2 episodes, and she said, you know, I wish you'd made this 50 years ago so that, you know, if we'd seen it, we would realize how difficult it was for our boys over in the Pacific. We would have been better wives, mothers, and sisters. You know, and so I'm proud of that too. Is that war is not just for the men; it's for families. It just corrodes everybody.
It's interesting for you because you were making. I mean, before we went on the air, you were talking about how this is really an anti-war movie about war, in a way similar to the way the Iliad is an anti-war epic.
Yeah, we were very, very. Cognizant of the fact that we had to make something that was showing the good war, and it was the good war. It had to be won. The costs of not winning that war would have been disastrous for the world. But it was a nasty war, like all wars. And to be honest about that and not blind the audience by patriotism or, you know, some of the old tropes of filmmaking, to really show it like it was. And I think that's enormously important for people to understand, you know, how horrible war really is, and how attractive it is at the same time, you know, for young men.
Right.
And just be honest about it. Don't be judgmental about it. Just try and present it in all of its panoply of emotions and tragedy and heroism and all, you know, it's the greatest crucible for drama because it's got every human emotion in it imaginable.
And that attractiveness to the young men, particularly in this film, who are signing up. I mean, today we have a completely different situation, like why somebody wants to sign up to go to war. But in those days, the passion that these young guys had, and I was watching it thinking, you know, these are warrior primates.
Yeah.
Doing what they, not me as a woman, but that these young men are just wired to do on some fundamental level.
I think you're right. And also, I mean, it's very easy to look at the Second World War and sort of view it through a rosy lens and, you know, things were simpler, but they weren't. And young men joined the military in 1941 and 42 for many of the same reasons they do today. I mean, I interviewed a Marine who said, look, I didn't have regular meals during the Depression until I joined the Army, until I joined the Marines. But you're right, there was a deep sense of patriotism at that time, especially after Pearl Harbor. And there was an atavistic sense of protecting the country and protecting our own. The war in the Pacific was racially tinged, there's no question about it. More ironically on the Japanese side than on the American side, which a lot of people don't realize.
What do you mean?
The Japanese demonized everything and everybody. And they were a very savage foe. I mean, they killed 30 million Chinese people from 1936 to 1945. They killed 1 million people in Vietnam. And a lot of this is simply racially motivated. And they felt the same way about the Marines. And the Marines immediately reciprocated, as we show in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a motivation behind the war. I think there are more traditional geopolitical reasons for that. But it certainly colored it in a way that the war in the European theater did not have.
We're talking to Bruce McKenna about his HBO miniseries, The Pacific. When you're writing a 10-part miniseries, that's a very long form. It's literally epic. What can you do in that form, and what are the challenges of it?
The biggest challenge when you have a large canvas as opposed to a 2 or 3 hour movie is the false sense of, oh, I've got lots of time, because you don't. And so you really still have to apply, and I talk about this in my lecture on next Tuesday, you have to apply the Aristotelian notions that have informed drama for 2,500 years of unities of character, unities of place. You have to boil it down, limited characters. You know, you have to, the standard things that dramatists have to do still apply. But you do have more time to develop your characters. It doesn't have to be as kabuki-like as a two-hour film would be. But you have to watch out for diffusion over 10 hours. How do you maintain a dramatic tension throughout the piece? And that's very difficult, for hour to hour. And with The Pacific, we have three main characters. How do you connect them? How do you ensure that the audience is still engaged with each character's journey? And how do these journeys intertwine? I was very fortunate enough to do a lot of research and have characters that did, in fact, historically intertwine the way that we show in the series. And there's some artifice there, too. But you really have to be... when you paint a large canvas, you can very quickly lose the focus of the painting if you're not careful. And that was the biggest challenge of the series.
Who were these characters? These were the three main characters that you used based on actual historical people?
Yes. John Bassillon was the most famous Marine in the 1940s. Eugene Sledge wrote the most harrowing combat memoirs probably of the 20th century. A book called With the Old Breed, and Robert Leckie, who was a famous writer after the war, who served in the 1st Marine Division with the other two. And they're all real. There's only one composite or two composite characters in the entire piece. The rest of them are all real characters.
And were any of them alive when you were doing your research?
Yes, yeah, and that's always a dicey thing. The wives were still alive, some of the wives, a few of the Marines, and we interviewed them for many, many, many hours, put them on tape, and involved them. I mean, if I wrote a scene, as a dramatist you have to do this, making a compression of time or events, I would call them and say, look, I have to do this in order to, I've only got 55 minutes to present, 80 days of Okinawa, I would ask their permission. And very rarely would they balk, because if you let them know that you're capturing the spirit of their character and the spirit of the times, and that's the job of the historical dramatist, is to capture the spirit, get to the underlying truth, they're very comfortable with it. And they've been complimentary about the series, universally complimentary about the series.
And what's interesting is the series really appeals to a very wide cross-section of the American public, red state, blue state,
yes.
Veterans, anti-war activists.
Yes, and it was the same with Band of Brothers. Fully half of the audience for Band of Brothers were women. And because Band and also The Pacific captures something about men that women wonder about and are attracted to and are horrified by and are, want to try and get a handle on. Again, the key to The Pacific is it's not political. There's not an ounce of, there's no red state, blue state stuff in the show, but yet you can look at it from the point of view of American heroism and a traditional American, the sort of the traditional view of America in World War II. And you can look at it in a more modern sense of, my God, what is the cost of war? Look what we did. It's my contention as a person, not so much as a writer, that the Second World War is America's greatest triumph, and it destroyed us. We lost our soul in the Second World War because we had to use absolute power to win. People who do that, or a society that does that, you never go back from that.
Right.
Once you know that you can crush the world, it's very hard to come back from that. And we've struggled as a society for 60 years with our responsibility on the world stage, and sometimes we do well and sometimes we don't. But we learned that in the Second World War, because...
One could argue that we didn't learn it. I mean, if you look at the 1950s and the period of you know, McCarthyism and suburbia that came out of World War II, you could really
think
about a kind of denial and unwillingness to really examine any of that.
Well, you could, but I would turn the question around and say, look at the societies. If they had won the war, what would have happened to the world? And it would have been a far worse place than the imprint of American imperialism or cultural imperialism, or, you know, whatever you want to look at. The American dominance of the world after the Second World War is far more benign than if Nazi Germany had won, or if Imperial Japan had won, or if the Soviet Union had borne the brunt of the war in Europe and dominated Europe.
Well, right, which is a slightly different question than have we examined what we did?
Well, yes, and the answer to that, of course, is not enough. We never examine enough of what we did, and I hope the Pacific makes people think about, you know, the Second World War in a more mature light, in a more wide open light, but without any political. I mean, it really, we consciously tried to emulate the Iliad of divorcing politics from it, and say, look at what this does to young men. You know, please don't be so gung-ho before you. You know, I talk about this in my lecture. I was called by an Israeli reporter who was interviewing me, and she showed the series to her 16-year-old son before his induction in 2 years into the Israeli military, because he was very gung-ho, couldn't wait, that primate that you talk about that can't wait to be in the army, and it tempered his enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is, you know, I hope it does that for millions of young men.
Very interesting. We're talking to Bruce McKenna, the creator of the HBO miniseries The Pacific. Now, as one watches The Pacific, I mean, you've got nearly unlimited budget, it seems like, for the filming of this. I mean, it's the highest possible production values, great actors, and kind of the standard Hollywood musical score and all of that kind of thing. And so the form is so familiar to people, you kind of plug in, oh yeah, you know,
war
epic
movie.
Miniseries form.
Yeah, war movie, flags waving in the background.
Yeah, and so does that, I mean, I guess you probably didn't have that much to do with that, being the writer. You didn't, you know, some other people are doing the sort of typical Hollywood stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting beast. I like to call, you know, it's our Trojan horse, essentially, is what it is. Because you're right. There are some traditional tropes in it, the music or the very format, the fact that you're watching it on a television. And, you know, there were a lot of us who helped produce the show, and we did have input. Everybody had input, and I had the opportunity to talk to them about the music. But the heart of the show is in the writing and in the directing and in the acting. And it's very clear what the show is about from the very first frame all the way through. And, you know, I remember early on the days of developing it, the executives go, well, how do we, you know, what is the show about? What's it about? What is it, Band of Brothers Part 2? It's Band of Brothers Across the Pacific. Is it? And I'm like, just relax. You know, it's going to be fine. And all the writers had a very clear image. I mean, frankly, we were doing the Iliad and the Odyssey is what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
And just get out of our way.
The Odyssey, too. So I haven't seen the second half yet. There's a coming home.
There is a coming home, and which we did not have on Band of Brothers. And I'm very proud. We have an entire episode of them coming home and the grave uneasiness of warriors when they get home, the inability to connect with their families when they get home, and how do they connect when they get home. Eugene Sledge, you know, he had nightmares for the rest of his life till the day he died.
Yeah.
And like Holocaust survivors, their children and their children's children are also Holocaust survivors. It's the same with combat veterans. Their children are victims of the war as much as the men in many ways. And this the trope of violence and the effect that it has on men gets passed down through the generations in very, very interesting and disturbing and poignant ways. And we do that in the 10th episode.
What are you going to be talking about on Tuesday? We're talking to Bruce McKenna, and his lecture on Tuesday is called Hollywood Does History.
I'm going to talk about the challenges that screenwriters face when they do adapt the historical record into film, because it's a different you know, we're always accused of being hacks, or, you know, you said it yourself, a Hollywood writer, just, you know.
Well, before I met Kirk Ellis, who wrote John Adams and who also lives here as you do, I thought, oh boy, what's this guy going to be like? And
yeah,
he's brilliant and profound. And
yes.
So there are these people.
There are.
Who are highly educated like you, like Kirk Ellis, doing this stuff.
And, you know, and we're both, I mean, I was in a PhD program in Russian history, and so I understand history, I understand the rules of history. And, you know, so I'm going to talk about, I'm going to defend the choices that we make, the compressions, the fictionalizations, because the rules of drama are different than the rules of history. But we're actually in service of the same thing, and that is an attempt to get at the truth.
Well, one thing that I would like to maybe slightly challenge on that is history, the writing of history, is inherently dealing with politics, and you are saying very vociferously that this is not dealing with politics.
It depends on your history. I mean, there are social histories. There are many different kinds of histories, and a lot of them, the traditional history deals with politics. You're right. But you could write a very good dramatic history of the Pacific that was great drama, that was more political, and it would not be less or true than some tome about it. And, you know, the one thing about historians that people forget is they, no matter how much they claim they're social scientists and they're empirical and they're like Francis Bacon, et cetera, their emotional and political valences, their prejudices inform their work. And they exclude as much evidence as does a screenwriter. And a screenwriter's job is to capture a different kind of truth in a different way. And I would argue, and I will argue in my lecture, that actually film, in many cases, provides a better grasp of an historical event than any book can do for certain, you know, certain kinds of, a certain way of looking at history.
Bruce McKenna is the principal writer, researcher, co-executive producer on the miniseries The Pacific, which is an HBO series. It won many Emmy Awards. And he's giving a lecture on Tuesday, the 7th of December, at the Armory for the Arts, titled Hollywood Does History. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be speaking of the arts in just a few minutes. Please stay tuned. And I would like to welcome Rob DeWalt. He is with Pase Tiempo, Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's with us here every Friday speaking of the arts. Welcome.
Welcome. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah. And Anne Maxwell is with us to talk about the El Dorado Children's Theater and Teen Players production of The King and I. That's opening, what, tonight?
Yes, it's opening tonight at 7 o'clock, and then it runs for 2 weekends. And so we've got a couple of matinees on Saturday and Sunday, and our Friday performances are our night performances. And it's going to be, if you can forgive me a little bit of shameless self-promotion, a great show. The kids are probably practicing their songs as we speak.
I know, we were hoping to have some kids on. I think they overslept.
Too. Well, and I'm certainly not going to sing anything for you this morning, much as I would like to.
And I'm not either.
But I tell you, the audience is going to be, they'll know practically every song.
How do you, in The King and I, which, what was that, Yul Brynner back in the day?
It was Deborah Kerr and Yul Brynner.
And so then you've got 17-year-olds playing this, you know, mature bald guy.
That's right. But our star, JD, who's an 18-year-old, yes, he's still a teenager, but he really pulls it off. He's got the stance. He's got that kind of alpha
attitude,
male.
Right?
Yes, he really. And our costumes transport you into Siam, which is, of course, the present-day Thailand. It's a story I'm sure everybody knows of Anna Leonowens, who went over there to become the teacher of his countless wives and children in the 1860s.
So The King and I is at the James A. Little Theater. You can call 466-4656 for tickets, and it's tonight and tomorrow. Well, tonight at 7 o'clock and tomorrow and Sunday at 2 in the afternoon.
That's right, and then a repeat next weekend.
And the repeat
Friday
next
night
weekend.
And Saturday and Sunday on 2 o'clock.
And Maxwell, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And Rob DeWalt.
Howdy.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm a little more awake. Had some coffee.
Yeah.
So
caffeine is a good thing.
Yeah.
In moderation.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So what's happening this weekend?
All kinds of stuff is happening this weekend. There's tons of openings. I'll read off a couple here that are happening tonight. Allen Day Contemporary over there on 129 West Water Street is having a show called A Decade of Light. Mixed media on steel by Lynn Demurge, I believe is how you pronounce it. There's a reception tonight from 5 to 8 p.m., and that shows up through December. Center for Contemporary Arts Spectre Rips Project Space has a show up called Crux. Architectonic Paintings by Mocha Leger, I think is how you pronounce it. Reception 6 to 8 p.m. Tonight through February 13th. I don't know what an architectonic painting is.
I don't either.
I don't.
But I bet it has architectural elements in it, and it may even have sort of 3D-ish qualities. But I don't know.
Also, the Museum of Contemporary Native Art down there on Cathedral Place is having their second annual Indigenous Bling Show. So, jewelry, of course, reception 5 to 7 tonight. That's up through January 2nd of next year. Peyton Wright Galley, their annual Art of Devotion show, is going on. Work from Spanish Colonial America. There's a reception tonight from 5 to 8 p.m. That's over there on East Palace Avenue, sorry. And there's all kinds of stuff going on. You just talked about The King and I. Tooth of Crime.
The King and You?
The King and I. King and Me. Tooth of Crime, Second Dance, Sam Shepard's redo of Tooth of Crime is opening this evening at the Greer Garson Theater.
Oh,
there.
Right. Yeah, they sent me a notice about that. I didn't have a chance to get anybody on, but yeah.
Yeah, there's a great story by me in Pasta Tiempo today on page 32. You can check it out. I interviewed Victor Talmadge, the director, and I also interviewed the musical director. And that is happening. Wow, that tonight it opens at 8 p.m., and that's running through December 12th. There's multiple shows. So if you call 988-1234 or go to the TicketSantaFe.org box office, you can find tickets for that show.
And the first annual, I love it when they say first annual, the first annual Holiday Cartoon Film Festival and exhibit and sale of Grinch art.
What?
Yes, the Chuck Jones Gallery. And Ricardo Cate will read How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and he will lead a master cartoon drawing class on how to draw and have fun while doing so. There will be a raffle to give away a lithograph of the title card from How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And all of this is tomorrow from 10 to 5 at the Chuck Jones Gallery, chuckjones.com.
I think it's unfortunate that we didn't get anything on that over at the Pasta Tiempo. But you know what? That happened sometime and we got it covered. On Saturday, there's Collected Works Bookstore is hosting a discussion and a book signing with Lois Ellen Frank, who's a chef and photographer and author.
Yes.
And Sharon Niederman, who's a author and writer and all kinds of
and has
cool
a
stuff.
Has a new book on New Mexican tasty treats and recipes and all those kinds of things.
It's an awesome book.
Yeah.
I have an extra copy if you want one.
I interviewed her. I have my own copy.
Okay, cool.
We can make Hatch green chili muffins.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah.
Or something along those lines.
Yeah. There's all kinds of great recipes in there, but there's also a bunch of neat little anecdotes and stories.
Yeah.
And
characters. No, she was very clear about saying this is not a cookbook.
No. No, it's a foodie roadmap of culture and history in New Mexico.
Exactly. What a nice way of putting it. You should be a journalist.
I should. Holly Arnold Kinney is also joining them. She runs the Fort Restaurant in Colorado, and it's a beautiful book. I believe Holly was here before doing an event for the New Mexico History Museum fundraiser, and she's back. That's at 4 p.m. at Galisteo, Collected Works Bookstore on Saturday.
Which is on the corner of Galisteo and Water.
That's correct. What else? From Broadway with Love. Kay Ballard, Donna anyway, some folks are going to be performing in a benefit concert for Animal Protection of New Mexico at 7:30 p.m. at the Lenzic on Saturday. There's a story on page 28 in the Pasta Tiempo. There are various ticket prices.
Donna McKechnie.
McKechnie.
Lillian Montevecchi.
Montevecchi.
And Kay Ballard.
Kay Ballard.
Yes.
Okay.
From Broadway with Love. Big event.
Big event. Big event.
If you like Broadway.
Yeah.
Lots of people do.
What else is going on? Museum of New Mexico Press Holiday Book Sale, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Today. at the Stuart Udall Center, second floor.
I was just corrected. McKechnie.
McKechnie.
Yes.
Ah, okay. Sorry. You have someone else talking in your ear?
No, I have a chat stream from the radio station.
Oh.
From the fabulous and highly informed Marilyn LeBlanc.
That's why you sound so smart all the time.
Oh, shush.
All right.
No, it's that I'm looking things up on Wikipedia as we speak.
Oh, okay. What else?
The String Orchestra students of El Dorado, Capshaw, and Ortiz schools, public schools here in Santa Fe, team up with the Santa Fe Community Orchestra in a side-by-side performance on Sunday, the 5th of December at 2:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium. The public is invited. The event is free. Come and be enchanted.
You know, this weekend is Winter Spanish Market. And that's presented by the Spanish Colonial Arts Society. That's happening over at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday. And on Sunday, it's happening from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. also. And there's no charge for that. You can get more information by calling 982-4585. There's this great thing also that's going on at, I believe it's happening at the Santa Fe Complex, called the Notions of Time.
We talked about that yesterday. That's such an interesting show. Tell us about it.
Well, the complex is hosting 2 days of music, short talks, film and video, art, photography, and as part of Art and Music 2010. Clarinetist James Shields, violinist Dave Felberg, cellist Dana Weinegrad, and pianist Connor Hannock. There's going to be lectures. There's going to be all kinds of things. There's going to be a screening of Godfrey's
Koyaanisqatsi. That's a great movie.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great movie. Godfrey's a character for sure. 6 p.m. on Friday. There's all of this music, and then there's a screening at 8 p.m. There's video and art displays shown throughout the event. There's a story in the Paso Tiempo on page 38. Or you can also visit sfcomplex.org.
And you can also go to santafe.radiocafe.org and listen to yesterday's show, which was very interesting, because tomorrow they're going to have a dozen people or more giving 10-minute talks about the nature of time. And we've got philosophers, spiritual people, scientists, science writers, yeah, all of them talking about, yeah, time. And it turns out when you try to define time, which you may not have time to do, but if you do, it's not so easy.
No, it's not. So it's sort of like speed dating for the intellect. Each person gets 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's super cool. And I think they're screening Koyaanisqatsi again.
Oh.
Tomorrow night.
What else is going on?
Sunday at 4 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, the second annual holiday celebration with readings by Bob Martin, Ally McGraw, Carol McGriffin, and Jonathan Richards. Did you announce that already?
I did not.
Oh, okay. And then Monday at 6 o'clock, poets Victor de Suvero and Robert Rhodes will be joined by singer Consuelo. I want to say Consuelo Luz, but that's not what it says. It says Consuelo Rios.
Maybe it's a typo?
I don't know.
Huh. When is that?
That's on Monday at 6 o'clock.
Monday at 6 o'clock. On Saturday is the Institute of American Indian Arts Holiday Art Market. It's an annual show of work by faculty, staff, students, alumni, and other Native artists. That's from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. over there at the Institute of American Arts, 83 Avenue Po Road. You can call 424-5704.
IAIA.
IAIA. I'm assuming there's no charge for these.
Yeah, it's Consuelo Luz. It was a typo.
Consuelo Luz.
And Orlando Romero will also be there, according to their website.
Sweet.
Yep.
Sweet. I think they're at some point, I don't know what day it is, but they're doing the lighting of the menorah on the plaza. Is it Sunday? I think it's Sunday.
Excellent. Then here's a big event, which not everybody knows about. It's a special evening tonight with Cuban literary superstar Pablo Armando Fernandez as he reads from his poetry tonight at 6 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium, followed by a reception. It's co-sponsored by the Lannan Foundation, the Museum of New Mexico Foundation, and several others. And there will be, people who attend will receive a keepsake poem of Armando's specially printed Palace Press, a poem that's printed by the Palace Press. And of course, they do wonderful work, often on really beautiful paper. Limited seating, so go check it out.
That's cool. Hey, this sounds fun. And I like the title more than anything else because it's kind of a Broadway mashup. Hey, you little American idiot, go get your Spamalot. Santa Fe High School students and a musical showcase of tunes from Little Women, Annie Get Your Gun, Spamalot and American Idiot, which of course is the Green Day musical that's blowing up on Broadway, whatever. Opening night is this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on the Santa Fe High School campus. That's over there on Yucca. There's ticket prices. They're pretty reasonable. The show is continuing through December 17th.
Excellent.
So you can
Spamalot.
Right. More Than Mary Cassatt. The lecture and film series ends with a presentation by Diane Armitage. She's going to present the 2008 documentary on figurative painter Alice Neal. CCA and the New Mexico Committee of the National Museum of Women in the Arts is presenting this at CCA Cinematheque on Thursday at 10 o'clock in the morning. You can call 982-1338 or go to the CCA website, I'm sure, for more information.
Santa Fe Art Institute presents writer, curator, and artist Lucy Lepard. She's giving a lecture on Thursday of next week, the 9th of December. It's called Expecting the Unexpected, Art and Climate Change. It's at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, and it's part of the Santa Fe Art Institute's theme for 2010, Elemental, Earth, Air, Fire, Water, Art as Environment. And they've been doing incredible things. They did that action in the Santa Fe River. They're doing so much at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And Lucy Lepard is one of the treasures of our state.
Indeed. You know, out in my neck of the woods this weekend is the old, and that's with an E on the end, just
old.
To be sure. Old-fashioned country Christmas fair from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. Home-baked goods, a nice big meal, live entertainment, raffles. That's at the Pecos Community Center on Main Street. Pecos is pretty small. You can't miss it. So go and check that out. I don't have any contact information for that, but it's a nice out-of-town thing to do, if that's what you want to do. Also, on Wednesday, the Music Critic Speaks. The Santa Fe Opera Guild presents a lecture by James Keller, who just happens to be Pasa Tiempo's staff music critic and writer.
Yes.
That's at 5 p.m. over there at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Santa Fe on West Barcelona Road. If you call 629-1410 extension 113, you can find out ticket information, all that good stuff.
Most excellent. Yeah. On, let's see, the Tuesday, December 7th at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, the Buckman Direct Diversion ChemRisk Water Quality people are having a meeting. They're asking women with children and pregnant women to come and talk about the importance of water safety standards for the Buckman Diversion Project. I don't know much about this, but you can go to bddproject.org for more information.
Here's a great local organization to be proud of, the Fine Arts for Children and Teens.
Yes.
They've recently won some sort of very big national award, or recognition anyway. Santa Fe City Hall is going to host their annual student exhibit. There's a reception tonight from 4 to 6 p.m., and that show is up through January 2011. You can go check that out downtown. What else? What else? Carl Denson's Tiny Universe, jazz, funk, and R&B sextet is playing at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday at the Santa Fe Brewing Company out there on Fireplace Road. You can get tickets at the Lenzic. You can call 988-1234, or you can go to the TicketsSantaFe.org website to find ticket information. What else? Barbara Lee Smith on Saturday is going to be talking in conjunction with the exhibit Poetic Landscapes at Jane Sauer Gallery. That's 2 p.m. on Saturday.
Yay.
I haven't seen that show yet. Have you?
No, I haven't seen anything. I have not been out to Canyon Road for way too long.
I believe also Upper Canyon Road is having a studio tour this weekend. If I can find the information for it while you
find the information for it, I will tell people that... Why is my computer weird? Okay, here we go. That Youth Shelters invites you to a holiday supporter appreciation cocktail party with great food, live music, and a silent auction at 434 West San Francisco Street. It's tonight from 5 to 6 in the evening. Oh, dear. It says, please RSVP to Heather. Okay, well, if you want to do that today, call 983-0586.
Here it is.
Youth Shelters.
Upper Canyon Road Studios Open House. 1519 and 1521 Canyon Road, more than a dozen artists, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. I used to live on Upper Canyon Road up there.
Really?
Yeah, in Steve Martin's old house.
Steve Martin lived here?
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, very briefly.
He's a very good banjo player.
Yeah, and he's a good writer. I'm reading his new book right now.
Oh,
it's pretty fantastic.
I saw that on Facebook.
It's kind of an interesting fictional tale, but it sort of revolves around the art world in the 90s in New York. And it's pretty catty in places. It's interesting. I think he's
one of the funniest and brightest people of our generation.
Yeah, he's a banjo. I mean, if you play the banjo, you have to be smart. That's what I've decided.
He wrote. I have on. I saw on the internet the other day on YouTube, the Atheist's Hymnal, and he does this great four-part harmony, kind of bluegrass song. For atheists, it is very, very funny. It's like an atheist hymn.
Is that on his new album, the new bluegrass album that he just put out? The one he won a Grammy for?
I have no idea.
It sounds familiar.
But today, from 8:30 in the morning, which is 20 minutes ago, until 3 in the afternoon, the Department of Cultural Affairs, authors and friends of the Museum of New Mexico Press invite you to a holiday sale and open house at the second floor of the Stuart Udall Center on Museum Hill. And there's all sorts of out of print books and slightly damaged books and titles some of them are up to 90% off, and they're having that today. So go check it out for more information, 476-1158.
I don't think I mentioned this, but I'm still waking up. The Baca Street Art Tour is this weekend also. Celebrating its 10th anniversary, the Baca Street Art Tour runs from 5 to 9 p.m. today, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. 20 artists are opening their studios, and they're all within walking distance of each other, so you don't have to drive around, find a place to park. Photographs, glasswork, jewelry, there's going to be Christmas ornaments, some artist demonstrations, and there's a little visitor participation in this if you want to. You can make glass blown ornaments, and you can make glass paperweights. There's a fee to do that. But anyway, the tour starts at Liquid Glass Studio at 926 Baca Street. You can call 820-2222 for more information. 5% of sales are benefit Warehouse 21, the teen, and I like to call it a teen and young adult art center. In
nice.
So that's,
you know,
this
and this is really, I would say, ladies and gentlemen, this is a really good day to go get the Posse Tempo if you don't already subscribe or don't already have it, because there is so much going on in terms of holiday stuff. I can't even read all the different holiday sales that are going on, not to mention cultural events. The Zia Singers and the Santa Fe Men's Camarada.
Yes.
Together again. Saturday and Sunday, Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 4 in the afternoon at the Scottish Rite Center. Holiday refreshments will be served during intermission, and students are free, and singers get it from other choral groups get a discount. For more information, you can call 466-3637.
Did we mention Beethoven, Complete Piano Trios 2?
No.
Pianist Peter Pizik, violinist Ari Winnick, and cellist Jack Smith. 12:10 to 1:15 p.m. I know that's correct, but it's just strange that it's 10 minutes after. Junior Common Room, that's today.
They should have said 12 so that everyone would show up on time.
I know. I mean, they do that at bars. They say doors open at 6, and that way they can sell a bunch of beer because the show doesn't start till 9.
Right.
What else is going on? TGIF recital, the Chancel Bell Choir. Ooh, Bell Choir. I love those. And the High Desert Harp Ensemble are playing at 5:30 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church over there downtown at Grant Avenue. You can call 982-8544, extension 16. Donations for that one. What else? Let's see.
What
else?
You
know, the Smashing Pumpkins are playing in Albuquerque. I just wanted to mention that because a lot of people think that they're not together anymore. But the Alt-Rock Legends are playing at Sunshine Theater on Tuesday, December 7th. In Albuquerque at Sunshine Theater. You can call 505-764-0249 for ticket information, or you could just go to sunshinetheaterlive.com.
Candace Walsh and Laura Andre are doing a reading at Collected Works Bookstore on Saturday at 6 o'clock next week, Saturday the 9th of December. The book is called Dear John, I Love Jane, Women Write About Leaving Men for Women. And so that's at Collected Works Bookstore. And I'm going to have them on the air sometime next week.
Next week?
Yeah.
Before we end, I have a cute little dog story. Do you have a second?
I do.
Okay.
I always have time for cute little dog stories.
My partner's sister was in Texas recently with our godkids. visiting a sick family member, and they were staying at a campsite for a couple of days, and a five-and-a-half-month-old brindle pit bull wandered into their camp. He was abandoned, malnourished. They took care of him for a couple of days. She called me, asked me what to do. I called the Humane Society Animal Shelter of Santa Fe. They said, don't leave the dog in Texas. Bring the dog back here, because it's a bully breed. Anyway, we got the dog. We took it to the vet just to get it checked out, and with the help of Pecos Paws, which is a fairly new organization, the dog got its first round of shots. It got a medical evaluation, and it got neutered. He got neutered yesterday, and he's soon going to be ready for adoption. And if anyone has...
Is he the cutest little thing ever?
He's the cutest little thing. I spent Thanksgiving with him, and I got so attached to him.
Why don't you keep him?
Because I have a, like, 8 or 9-year-old Rottweiler who's kind of slowing down, and she's just not really excited to have a really hyper... You know, puppies are hyper.
But she could make the other one feel young again.
Well, I have another puppy who does...
My dog, Honey, was getting old and fat and lazy, and she became a couch potato, and she was watching soap operas all day. So I got her a little white puppy and called it Milk, and she was... It made her young again.
We tried that, you know, and the puppy has no problem with our dogs. It's our dogs have a problem with the puppy, and sometimes that happens in households. But anyway, we're looking for a loving sort of forever home for this dog.
Oh, okay.
If somebody wants to contact me, if it's a rescue opportunity or whatever, they can email me over at the Paso Tiempo. My information is in there. They can call 986-3039, and I'll give them the skinny on the not-so-skinny-anymore puppy.
And if you missed any of that, you can always write to me, too, radiocafe@ksfr.org, and I will pass it on.
Okay.
I try to answer my email. I do now have almost 9,000 emails in my inbox. I was down to about 200 not very long ago. They just pile up.
You just need to close your eyes. Select like 8,000 of them.
I know, but then there's important things, and then people, they're already offended because I don't answer them, but I can't. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening and I haven't answered you, I can't do it all. I try my best.
You need an intern. That's what you need.
I know. I need
an unpaid intern.
Ladies and gentlemen, unpaid interns, radiocafe@ksfr.org. Christmas annual antique and book sale. New Mexico authors Ann Hillerman, Sharon Udall, Ann Lacey, Ann Valley Fox, Lane Cutler, Kathy Flynn, Penn Lafarge, Arnold Vigil, and Nancy Wood are going to be at Garrett's Desert Inn from 8:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon tomorrow, December 4th. And it's a Christmas book gifts, postcard, WPA furniture, collectible books, all kinds of good things. National New Deal Preservation Association.
Have you ever seen it? Oh, free parking. In this town, that means something, folks. Have you ever heard of filmmaker John Motetsugu?
Yes.
He's also in a band called Low on High here in town.
Right, sort of punky,
weird
stuff.
Yeah. Post-punky. Anyway, he makes some great films. He just wrapped shooting sort of this strange horror film here in Santa Fe. He is going to be... There's this thing called A Day with John Motetsugu that's happening on Wednesday. Santa Fe University of Art and Design Moving Image Arts Department and The Screen are hosting a workshop, film screening, and panel discussion with him. Actress Amy Davis, who's in most of his films, or all of his films, probably, and indie film distributor Tetsuki Ijichi.
Yes.
Event is starting at noon on Wednesday over there at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. No charge for the workshop and discussion. You can call 473-6011 for scheduling details.
And that is it for Speaking of the Arts. Rob DeWalt is with the Paso Tiempo, Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. He's with us every Friday, Speaking of the Arts. And we will see you next week.
Yes, we will. Happy Hanukkah, everybody.
Happy Hanukkah. Happy winter.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz a la carta. Hasta la vista, baby. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
See you, and have a nice, wonderful, safe, happy weekend. Ciao. Thank you.